From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Yesterday, the first thing that happened as soon as this was announced, I was just crying. And there's so much pain in a lot of people because of the pandemic, and this is only putting more lives at risk.
More than a million. That's the number of international students enrolled in U.S. universities. ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, just announced they could be deported or denied visas back into the U.S. if their schools switch to online-only courses in the fall. We'll get response. Then we go to Texas to speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Dr. Sherry Fink, who's been reporting inside Houston's hard-hit hospitals.
We are here at Houston Methodist Hospital, which is the largest hospital in Houston. And right at this moment, the number of coronavirus cases is really rising dramatically in the city.
And we'll speak to emergency medical physician Dr. Uche Blackstock, founder of Advancing Health Equity, which works to fight racism and bias in health services.
Living in this country has essentially made Black Americans sick. And over the last 3 months, we have witnessed a crisis layered upon a crisis, as Black communities across this country have borne the greatest burden of illness and death from the novel coronavirus.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Trump administration's begun the process of officially withdrawing from the World Health Organization in a move condemned by public health officials across the world. The move came on the same day the WHO warned the global peak of the pandemic has still not been reached. The American Medical Association, American Academy of Pediatrics, American Academy of Family Physicians, and American College of Physicians condemned President Trump's decision, saying it, quote, puts the health of our country at grave risk. Former Vice President Joe Biden has vowed to reverse Trump's decision on his first day in office if he wins the November election. In Brazil, the nation's far-right president, Jair Bolsonaro, has tested positive for the coronavirus after months of downplaying the severity of the pandemic. Bolsonaro recently developed a high fever and a cough. Brazil's the second hardest-hit nation in the world after the United States, with more than 65,000 deaths and 1.6 million confirmed cases. Bolsonaro said Tuesday he's taking hydroxychloroquine, even though it has been proven ineffective against COVID-19 and sometimes dangerous.
Here, I'm taking my third dose of hydroxychloroquine. I'm feeling very well. I was feeling a little ill on Sunday. I was bad on Monday. Today, Tuesday, I feel better than on Saturday. So in all certainty, it's working.
Brazil-based journalist Glenn Greenwald noted Bolsonaro's announcement comes as Brazil is on day 53 of having no health minister. The last two were fired or resigned within 30 days of each other for endorsing science. The grandmother of Brazil's first lady, Michelle Bolsonaro, is also suffering from COVID-19. She was recently transferred to an ICU unit and is reportedly intubated. Here in the United States, more than 60,000 new coronavirus cases were reported Tuesday, a new record shattering the previous high. Nearly 3 million people have now tested positive for the virus. The U.S. death toll has topped 131,000. On Tuesday, President Trump and Education Secretary Betsy DeVos urged elementary and secondary schools to resume in-person classes in the fall.
So we're very much going to put pressure on governors and everybody else to open the schools, to get them open. And it's very important. It's very important for our country. It's very important for the well-being of the student and the parents.
The Maine teacher unions have warned reopening schools without a comprehensive safety plan would be, quote, putting students, their families and educators in danger, unquote. This comes as health facilities across Florida, Texas, Arizona and California are grappling with a surge in coronavirus patients as hospitals run out of ICU beds and run low on protective gear for medical workers. On Tuesday, Texas reported more than 10,000 cases in a day for the first time. Meanwhile, the Republican Party in Texas is planning to go ahead with holding an in-person state convention in Houston next week, despite opposition from the Houston mayor, Sylvester Turner, who appeared on CNN Tuesday.
Bringing 6,000 people together indoors over a 2 to 3 day event is not good on any level, not in the midst of a pandemic.
Meanwhile, a number of prominent Republican lawmakers have announced they will skip the party's national convention in Jacksonville next month. The list includes Senators Chuck Grassley, Lamar Alexander, Mitt Romney, Lisa Murkowski, and Susan Collins. Senator Grassley, who's 86, said, "I'm not going to go because of the virus situation." In Serbia, demonstrators stormed the parliament building in Belgrade Tuesday to protest the government's plan to reimpose a lockdown as COVID-19 cases spike there. In medical news, a report in The Lancet raises new doubts about whether areas can develop herd immunity to COVID-19. A large study in Spain found just 5% of the population had developed antibodies to the virus, even as more than 250,000 people tested positive for the disease, with over 28,000 deaths. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador is meeting President Trump at the White House today to mark the beginning of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA, which went into effect last week. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says he's skipping the meeting with Trump and López Obrador, citing scheduling conflicts and health concerns. Upon his arrival to Washington yesterday, President López Obrador was reportedly wearing a face mask, a protection he's largely ignored back in Mexico, after he, like Trump, initially downplayed the coronavirus pandemic. On Capitol Hill, Congress members Rashida Tlaib and Ayanna Pressley have introduced new federal U.S. criminal justice system in what organizers are calling a modern-day Civil Rights Act. The BREATHE Act was drafted in partnership with the Movement for Black Lives. It would slash Pentagon spending, divest federal resources from prisons and police departments, end mandatory minimum prison sentencing and life sentences, abolish the Drug Enforcement Administration and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and more. This is Black Lives Matter Movement co-founder Patrice Cullors.
Right now, the streets are swelling with demands for a new future and a new policy mandate. The Movement for Black Lives has responded with a vision that reflects these demands on a federal level. Our movement is strong, and we're inviting our nation's leaders to join us in making this vision a reality.
In Arizona, the Phoenix Union High School District said Tuesday it will no longer assign police officers to school campuses following weeks of student-led protests and petitions. This follows a similar decision by authorities in Columbus, Ohio, Monday to end the use of school resource officers. Here in New York, tenant rights advocates rallied outside housing courts in the Bronx and Brooklyn Tuesday, calling for a broader moratorium on evictions during the coronavirus pandemic. One recent study estimated up to 28 million renters across the country are at risk of eviction as the country faces its worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. Meanwhile, Black Lives Matter protesters continue to come under attack at demonstrations. And a warning to viewers, this next story contains graphic footage. On Tuesday evening, an SUV driver sped through a peaceful protest march in Times Square, narrowly missing several people. In Bloomington, Indiana, two people were injured Monday when a driver rammed a peaceful march demanding justice for a Black activist who survived an attempted lynching. And in Long Island, New York, police arrested a man Monday after he allegedly plowed his SUV into a crowd of Black Lives Matter protesters, injuring two people. Researchers at the University of Chicago have documented over 50 such attacks since protests erupted in May, warning right-wing extremists are turning vehicles into weapons. New Jersey wrapped up primary elections Tuesday with incumbent Democratic Senator Cory Booker easily defeating progressive primary challenger and civil rights activist Lawrence Ham. In New Jersey's 5th congressional district, progressive challenger Arati Krebik fell to unseat incumbent Josh Gottheimer. Krebik was endorsed by Senator Bernie Sanders. Gottheimer, who's backed by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, was judged the second most conservative Democrat in the House by the website govtrack.us. Elsewhere, U.S. 12-term Democratic Congress member Albio Cires fended off progressive challenger Hector Osegueda, a supporter of the Green New Deal, Medicare for All, and Black Lives Matter. In climate news, a new study by European scientists shows Arctic wildfires in June dumped more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere than any other month in 18 years of data collection. Temperatures in parts of Siberia above the Arctic Circle recently topped 100 degrees Fahrenheit for the first time in recorded history. This comes as new data for the 12-month period ending in June show global surface temperatures effectively tied with the hottest year on record. United Nations human rights investigators said Tuesday all warring factions in Syria's conflict committed war crimes during the recent Russian-backed Syrian government offensive on Idlib. The report found Syrians experienced unfathomable suffering during the campaign to retake Syria's last rebel-held region, which lasted from late 2019 until a ceasefire in March. This is Paulo Pinheiro, chair of the UN Commission of Inquiry on Syria.
All sides likely committed war crimes. Children were shelled at school, parents were shelled at the market, patients were shelled at the hospital, entire families were bombarded, even while fleeing these attacks.
International aid groups are warning of unprecedented levels of hunger in Syria after nearly a decade of war, with millions of people acutely vulnerable to COVID-19. In Mexico, there's a major development in the case of the 43 Ayotzinapa students who were kidnapped and disappeared nearly 6 years ago in the town of Iguala, Guerrero. A bone fragment found in the nearby town of Cocula has been determined to be from one of the students, 21-year-old Christian Alfonso Rodriguez Talumbre. The Mexican government has long claimed the bodies of the students were burnt and disposed of in a garbage dump in Cocula or in a nearby river. But the bone fragments were found in a different location, casting new doubts about the government's official account of what happened to the students. In Nairobi, Kenya, police fired tear gas Tuesday to clear crowds of demonstrators demanding end to police brutality amidst a mounting number of police killings during the coronavirus lockdown. Amnesty International reports Kenyan police have killed at least 100 people so far this year. This is activist Wanjiru Simmons.
We are tired of police brutality. We are tired of a weak justice system. We are tired of the rule of law not being obeyed. And we just want justice to be done for the many souls that have been lost by extrajudicial killings and all that is happening.
Back in the United States, civil rights leaders who've organized an advertising boycott of Facebook blasted the company Tuesday after a conference call with CEO Mark Zuckerberg and other top executives failed to meet their demands. Leaders of Color of Change, Free Press, the NAACP, and the Anti-Defamation League say the social media giant is continuing to allow hate speech and misinformation to proliferate on its platform. Nearly 1,000 companies have joined the Facebook advertising boycott. And in sports news, the Women's National Basketball Association, the WNBA, is dedicating its 2020 season to addressing the country's, quote, long history of inequality, implicit bias, and racism, unquote, disproportionately affecting Black and brown communities. WNBA players will highlight the Black Lives Matter and Say Her Name movements, some wearing a special uniform honoring Breonna Taylor, a 26-year-old Black woman and aspiring nurse who was shot to death by police inside her own apartment in March. Republican Georgia Senator Kelly Loeffler, a white woman and supporter of President Trump, who's co-owner of the WNBA's franchise, the Atlanta Dream, slammed the initiative, saying any alignment with the Black Lives Matter movement sends a message of exclusion. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York City, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez at his home in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, as the U.S. reported an alarming surge of 60,000 new coronavirus cases Tuesday, shattering the record of the day before, President Trump continued to pressure state governors to open schools in the fall. This comes as ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, announced Monday that thousands of international students enrolled in universities across the United States could face deportation or denied visas back into the U.S. if their schools switch to online-only courses in the fall due to the pandemic. More than a million international students were issued visas to study in the United States last year. They account for as much as a third of the undergraduate student body at many colleges and universities and are often the majority of graduate students. This is Elufemi Alurin, an Eastern Kentucky University student from the Bahamas, reacting to the decision.
I did come here legally. I've been legal. You know, I check in with the government. I pay my taxes. I do everything they tell me to do. If I move, I check in within 10 days. You know, I know the law. I did everything y'all told me to do. And it's still like, oh, we're going to take that map from under you. When you plan your life in your 20s and you start to get into that age where you're trying to set up a 5-year plan and a 10-year plan, obviously deportation isn't something you want to put in that plan. So it definitely took me by surprise.
ICE released its new guidance just hours after Harvard University announced that all of its classes will be online this fall. On Tuesday, Trump called Harvard's plan ridiculous.
I see where Harvard announced that they're closing for the season or for the year. I think it's ridiculous. I think it's an easy way out. And I think they ought to be ashamed of themselves. You want to know the truth. But I noticed that today, and probably others are doing that. That's called the easy way out.
This comes as the Trump administration announced plans last month to cancel the visas of thousands of Chinese graduate students who have ties to universities affiliated with China's military. Chinese students are the largest single foreign student population in the United States. Well, for more, we're joined by two guests. In Chicago, Fiona McEntee is an immigration attorney, and she's a former international student herself from Ireland, now a naturalized U.S. citizen. And in Union City, New Jersey, Jen Ren is with us, an international graduate student originally from China, pursuing a PhD in Latin American history at Rutgers University, where our co-host Juan Gonzalez is a professor. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Fiona McEntee, let's begin with you. Can you explain what ICE has just announced? There are something like 1.1 million international students in universities and graduate schools across the country. They could be deported or denied entry back into the U.S. if they went home. If their university, like Harvard, for example, does not offer in-person classes, ICE saying to them, you can transfer if you have to.
Yeah, Amy, that's exactly what's happened. So earlier on this week, we saw an announcement by ICE that essentially stated that if foreign students were attending universities that were going to be online only or participating in online only courses, then that they would not be able to maintain their student visa status, which leaves them with, you know, some pretty grim options, one of which was deportation was actually mentioned in the ICE statement, as you mentioned.
Fiona McEntee, but this is obviously no fault of the students if a particular university doesn't offer online courses. How does the administration justify this?
You know, that's a good question, and I have yet to see a justification for this. So historically, there were limits on the amount of online courses international students could take, and that makes sense in non-pandemic times. However, when COVID hit, allowances were made, and rightly so, to that policy. Flexibility was made, allowing foreign students to remain here and maintain their student status and study online. And I think a lot of stakeholders in this were expecting those allowances to continue, given that we're still in the middle of the pandemic. However, that was not the case. And I think it came as a shock to us all. And you're right, it's not the foreign students' fault. And to be honest, they're one of the most valuable asset that this country has. So it doesn't make any sense to me, and I've yet to see a clear justification for this.
So I wanted to follow up on that and ask you about the reaction by anti-immigration groups like Numbers USA, the right-wing restrictionist group. They've welcomed this policy. So it not only fits into President Trump's efforts to pressure universities, it also bolsters his anti-immigrant base as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, it definitely does. But there's really, I mean, you can look at immigration in a number of ways. You know, you can look at the cultural aspect of the diversity, but you can also look at it economically. And foreign students contribute about $41 billion per year to the U.S. economy, But just by being here, they created over 450,000 jobs. So that's by, you know, food services, healthcare. I mean, I've been contacted by landlords who have been saying, what am I going to do? Foreign students are my tenants. And, you know, now they're going to be, you know, deported or they're going to have to leave. So, I mean, it doesn't make sense from an economic point of view. And right now with, you know, the situation, you know, the economy is like needs a boost. And I just don't understand why now we would decide to expel foreign students here when they contribute so much to the U.S.
Fiona McEntee, I mean, just to understand, how does ICE enforce this? It means they have to cooperate. The universities and colleges across the country, who are now absolutely outraged by this very late, not to mention just what the content of the guidance is, they have to cooperate with ICE, right? Because they have to let them know if international students are only taking online courses. For example, places like Wands University and our next guest at Rutgers, they're going to offer a mix of online and in-person. You'd have to find out if this particular international student is taking only online courses. So will there be more cooperation? Will ICE demand information about the students? How do they enforce this?
Yeah, I mean, there is a certification process that's built into this. So the universities are supposed to report to ICE about whether or not the programs are going to be administered fully online or not. And you know, I think it's pretty jarring that in this statement, they did mention deportation. And for foreign students who you heard the lady earlier, I mean, they've given up so much. They come here, they pay so much tuition. They contribute so much while they're here. And they're also, you know, all the statistics show how many startups they create, how many jobs, you know, they don't have a negative impact on U.S. Wages. You know, it's quite the contrary. So, you know, it's very puzzling that you would force international students into in-person studies when there's a global health crisis in this country.
I'd like to bring in Jen Wren, a grad student at Rutgers University, ask you about your reaction once you when you heard the news of this.
It's shocking because the obscure language in this introduction impacts on me a lot. With the research nature of my degree as a PhD student, I should remain in the United States for academic purposes. I'm going to do oral history interview in New Jersey locally, and I have to teach undergraduate courses next semester. I find it impossible to do it in China, a country without free internet, for online courses, for delivering online lectures at 3 a.m. in the morning. But the instruction by the ICE only defines a student's right to remain in the United States by courses. So if I don't take online courses, I cannot fulfill other research obligations by my degree. And I was also shocked by the lack of knowledge by whoever drafted this instruction, or they just don't choose to understand the nature of academia in the United States, how a university operates, because different international students are taking different roles, different vital roles in a university to keep it operating.
I want to go to the tweet your tweet, Jen Wren, right after ICE made their announcement on Monday, shocking universities and colleges across the country, not to mention a million students. You wrote three common misperceptions. One, international students don't pay taxes. Two, international students can apply for a green card after graduation. And three, international students have freedom of speech when they're in the United States. Explain these three points. Start with taxes, Jen.
So as a PhD student, I and maybe all PhD students from overseas countries to the United States have to teach classes, and they are responsible for undergraduate education, and they are paid by the university. So they have to pay federal taxes in the United States, and our tax rate is often higher than average Americans because we don't have deductions in tax return. We have some, but they are not substantial deductions like Americans have. So that's the number one provision I provided, that we also pay taxes to the U.S. And secondly, there's no direct channel for us from a PhD degree, undergrad degree, or other kinds of degree to immigration. The F visa, the visa for international students, is not an immigrant visa. It's a non-immigrant visa, or we are called temporary visitors. It's our privilege to stay in the United States, but not a right. I fully understand this. And we are not going to be American citizens in a few years. It's simply impossible by law and by the current system. And thirdly, And thirdly, the freedom of speech part is a complicated issue. For me, I'm here to participate in the program. I'm facing a risk because in the next visa application, I have to renew visa in 3 years. The U.S. government will ask me about my social network information and scrutinize my opinions. It's a requirement implemented 3 years ago. So that's what I call there's no equal definition of freedom of speech for us international students in the U.S. compared with Americans.
And Jenren, I wanted to ask you, most Americans are not aware of the important role that foreign students play in maintaining American universities. For instance, at New York University, 20,000 students are foreign students. And many public universities, it's the foreign students who pay a full tuition, most of them, many of them, who are able to maintain the finances of these public universities as well. Could you talk about this role that foreign students play here as well?
Yes, in most state universities, public institutions, foreign students pay a higher tuition than American citizens in the U.S. And they actually boosted the economy around the campus, especially in college towns like New Brunswick in New Jersey. The car dealers, the landlords, the restaurants, the supermarkets rely on foreign students to survive.
What does it mean if you were to go back to China? China's reaction to this, and this is significant because of the 1.1 million foreign students, it looks like more than a third of them are Chinese students. Now, President Trump almost attempted this 2 years ago. His senior advisor, the fierce anti-immigrant Stephen Miller, apparently tried to just get Chinese students banned. I guess President Trump has now come to understand that courts don't like targeted bannings. Is this, do you think, a veiled way to go after Chinese students and attack China right now, Jenren? And how much does it cost to go home?
We have to check the reality of U.S.-China tensions right now. So with the pandemic and the deteriorating U.S.-China relations in the current moment, there is virtually no flights between China and the U.S., only 2 or 4 per week. And the one-way economy class tickets cost Chinese students more than $10,000. So if mass deportation begins, it's nearly impossible for hundreds of thousands of Chinese students to go home with both Chinese government and the U.S. government policy to manipulate flight tickets at this moment. And if the U.S. government is going to implement mass deportation by itself, it would be a heavy tax burden for average U.S. taxpayers.
I wanted to go back to Fiona McEntee and read you a tweet that came out soon after ICE announced they might deport or bar more than a million students from higher education in this country, foreign students. It said, petition for universities to create a one-credit course for international students called F-ICE 101 that meets in person once per semester with excused absences. F-ICE 102 to be taught next spring. Now, they gave the full word. But Fiona McEntee, what your recommendation is to the more than million international students in this country right now? You were once one of them.
Yeah, I was once one of them. And I think this is why, I mean, and I've worked with thousands of international students over the course of my career as an immigration lawyer. And so I see how much they bring to this country. And so, you know, I think that's an interesting idea for the in-person classes. But really, if they want to stay in their universities that they're in and the university or college is going to an online-only model,
no, that's okay.
You know, they're not going to be able to do that. So they do need some type of in-person class. And, you know, the foreign students are in class with American students. You know, they're next to, it's not like there's all just foreign students in a class together. So they're mixed in. So we're now going to require American students, forcing them to come into class to avoid, you know, risking deportation of their classmates and their friends. And, you know, I've yet to see any type of justification for this. And another option would be if they've to scramble to try to change schools when fall semester is starting in a couple of weeks. And so I think I've definitely seen the universities push back. I have seen an open letter that has been published online, and I was looking at it this morning. There's hundreds of signatures from professors from, you know, universities, colleges all over the US have signed on to this letter to oppose this policy that just doesn't make any sense. And so I think, you know, you might see some more pushback from the universities and maybe some modifications with adding some in-person classes. But, you know, why should they have to do that?
Well, it looks like President Trump wants to make it look like business is carrying on as usual in this country. He particularly attacked Harvard yesterday that announced no in-person classes, calling their decision ridiculous. And then ICE released its decision right after that announcement. Fiona McEntee, I want to thank you for being with us, immigration attorney, former international student from Ireland, and Jen Wren, international PhD student at Rutgers University in New Jersey, where Juan teaches as well. Next up, we go to Texas to speak with the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Dr. Sherry Fink, who's been reporting inside Houston's hard-hit hospitals. 10,000 new coronavirus cases in one day. That's the number for Texas alone. More than 60,000 cases in the United States. Stay with us.
What's that floating in the water? Oh, Neptune's only daughter. I believe in Mr. Greer's prayer for a man in the middle, one that talks like Doolittle. I believe in Mr.
Mr. Greaves, performed by TV on the Radio. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. This is the Quarantine Report. More than 60,000 new coronavirus cases were reported in the U.S. Tuesday, a record shattering the previous high. Nearly 3 million people have now tested positive for the virus, and the death toll has topped 131,000, though that number is expected to be far higher. As cases rise, hospitalizations are soaring. Health facilities in Florida, Texas, Arizona, and California are running out of ICU beds. On Tuesday, Texas set a grim new record of 10,000 new cases in a single day. Despite this, the Texas Republican Party still plans to hold its in-person state convention in Houston next week. Mayor Sylvester Turner went on CNN Tuesday, pleaded for the Republicans to reconsider.
Bringing 6,000 people together indoors over a 2 to 3 day event is not good on any level, not in the midst of a pandemic. And so I just would hope and pray that they will take into account the employees who will have to service that convention, the employees' families, the delegates themselves, the people in this city, and the people in the cities and the towns and cities that they are coming from. So I will continue to believe that wiser heads will prevail and that people will recognize that this is a pandemic and people are dying and people are getting infected and that the numbers in this state are going up and not going down.
The New York Times has been reporting extensively from inside Houston's hard-hit hospitals. In a moment, we'll be joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Dr. Sherry Fink, who's featured in this new video by The New York Times.
We are here at Houston Methodist Hospital, which is the largest hospital in Houston. And right at this moment, the number of coronavirus cases is really rising dramatically in the city.
How does it feel, similar or different to March?
This is the surge.
Although they had a moderate peak in April, now they're more than double the peak that they ever reached at that time. And the numbers look like they're going to just keep rising.
Since March, we've had a trickle of patients. Everyone stayed at home. People were not really getting sick in numbers that would overburden the system. Dr. Bakshi-Yar, in fact, some of us cut our shifts down because there weren't enough patients to see. Since probably Memorial Day, it's been a lot busier. Every patient who comes into the hospital now, we're testing for COVID.
That's a video from the New York Times featuring our guest, New York Times correspondent Dr. Sherry Fink. Her recent piece is headlined, "As Coronavirus Slams Houston Hospitals, It's Like New York All Over Again." Dr. Sherry Fink, thanks so much for joining us. If you can talk first about Houston and what you're finding there, you having come from the epicenter, covering what had happened here in New York as the epicenter switches and shifts to Houston.
Yes, there are a lot of similarities, unfortunately, and some differences. We can talk about both. But the similarities are just the numbers of new patients. They are stressing the hospitals here. The hospital that I've been embedded with, Houston Methodist Hospital, which is the largest hospital in Houston, as you heard, has just been, it's been astonishing. They've been adding unit after unit after unit just to care for coronavirus patients. And they can do that. Meanwhile, there's a safety net system. Those hospitals who are there to treat people who tend to be disproportionately affected by coronavirus, and they are just completely full and transferring their patients out. So this is very similar to New York in that way.
And Dr. Fink, in terms of some of the differences, though, it would seem that at least in the early days of the pandemic, especially on the East Coast, there were massive shortages of personal protective equipment, of the ability to test patients. How has those factors played out now in this months later in places like Texas?
So you would think months later we would have some of the systems in a better way, and certainly personal protective gear, there does seem to be more of that, although there have been some backups in getting certain pieces of that protective gear. But the testing is similarly a problem. This is a huge problem here. I think some of my colleagues did a really nice piece yesterday about this backup in testing, but I'm seeing it affecting the hospitals. So first of all, it's very hard to get a test here. You have to schedule it maybe sometime in advance. And then to get those results back is taking many days. Now, in the hospitals, when they get backed up, that is a problem, because when a person comes into the hospital at this point, when coronavirus is quite widespread in the community, they need to know whether that person should go on a coronavirus ward or on a non-coronavirus ward, and it's or just how to treat them. So this is very, very important to get those test results back. And, you know, there are backups. We're seeing that around the country. The labs are backed up.
I mean, this is absolutely astounding. As President Trump puts enormous pressure to open up the economy around the country, we are seeing this increasing lack of testing, the shortage of testing. We're showing lines of people in Texas, cars that are waiting something like 8 to 12 hours in Arizona. The same thing. The lines are something like 8 to 10 hours. Testing facilities are just shutting down sometimes after 5 minutes. They run out. If you could talk, Dr. Sharp, think about both the importance of, I mean, this lack of testing and the lack of masks, or President Trump not wearing a mask. Actually, the governor of Texas just recently saying masks must be worn, though it took a long time for Governor Abbott to get to this point. But why that's so important.
That's right. And in the piece that you talked about that ran over the weekend, it explored the differences and the similarities with New York. And the head of Houston Methodist system, medical system, he said that one of the things that is really striking him, and that if he could have one thing back from March, that awful time that we had in New York, but the one thing was that there was unity in terms of the measures needed to stop that spread. So you remember there was a national shutdown for a while, a pause. And at least you had the federal and the state and the local officials on the same page for that brief period of time. The problem now, as you said, is that because there's been such a division amongst officials who are giving messages to the public's confused. And so there are people getting the coronavirus and the doctors are saying, you know, who can blame them? They don't know, you know, with such mixed messages, it's very hard for a person in the public to really know who to trust. And maybe you trust that official who you voted for. So, yes, now it does seem that there is this focus, this importance of the masks. And there is some hope in the medical community that the universal masking, if everybody's wearing a mask, that that will start to drive down some of these numbers and maybe is starting to have a little bit of an effect. But I don't go out much here, but when I've you know, going back and forth to the hospital, I do see young people not masking. And that is, you know, the public health officials here and the medical folks are very concerned about that, because you have the other big difference is you have a younger patient population, which means that they generally are a little bit healthier. They're definitely critically ill people. And I'm watching some of the people I met the first day who were young going through getting sicker, some in the ICU. So, but generally they're healthier. The problem is, do those young people then infect older people who may be more vulnerable, or people with underlying conditions who are doing their best to stay safe? I've seen it over and over again. I've met very few patients who were the ones out partying. It's the ones who caught it from a family member who had an essential job. That's what I'm seeing. Or a small family gathering that they thought was safe, that included some younger members of the family. Those are the people who are ending up in the ICUs here, who just by random selection, who I'm tending to meet.
Dr. Sherry Fink, we have to break, but we're going to come back to you. Dr. Fink is a New York Times correspondent, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and writer. She is executive producer of the Netflix docuseries Pandemic, How to Prevent an Outbreak, and author of the widely acclaimed book on the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, titled 5 Days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital. She's reporting from the hospitals most hard hit by COVID-19, from New York to Houston. Stay with us.
Oh, my Lord, in July.
I'm so depressed by Abner Jay. This is Democracy Now!, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're looking at the coronavirus pandemic and disparities in treatment and in deaths. Newly released federal data shows African-American and Latinx people are nearly three times more likely to be infected and twice as likely to die from the virus compared to their white neighbors. The New York Times reported these figures after suing the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for the federal data. In April, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio acknowledged the racial disparities in the city's coronavirus death rates.
So now I have information that points out that there are clear inequalities, clear disparities in how this disease is affecting the people of our city. The deaths because of COVID-19 in the city, first and foremost, have affected the Hispanic community with 34% of the deaths. That community is about 29% of all New Yorkers in terms of population, but 34% of the deaths. And again, this is preliminary information that we'll keep adding to. It's hard to talk about this stuff like statistics. This means human beings. This means families. But we have to look in the face these disparities that we're learning about. So the Hispanic community, 34%. The Black community, 28% of the deaths, compared to about 22% of the overall population. The disparities that have plagued this city, this nation, that are all about fundamental inequality, are once again causing such pain and causing people, innocent people, to lose their lives. It's just abundantly clear. It's sick. It's troubling.
So that's wrong. That's Mayor de Blasio speaking recently. Still with us in Houston is Dr. Sherry Fink, New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who recently co-wrote a piece headlined, Why Surviving the Virus Might Come Down to Which Hospital Admits You. We are also joined by Dr. Uche Blackstock, emergency medicine physician and CEO and founder of Advancing Health Equity, a company that works with healthcare organizations to fight racism and bias in services. Dr. Blackstock, thanks so much for joining us as well. If you can talk about the disparities, who lives, who dies, and who gets sick and who doesn't.
Sure. You know, I think that, you know, before the pandemic, what that people may not realize is that there were pretty significant racial health disparities in this country. I think many people had heard about the Black maternal mortality crisis that had gotten a lot of press. But what we saw in the pandemic these first few months is these really significant racial health inequities being exposed and even amplified. We saw that, you know, Black and Latinx and Indigenous communities were more likely to be infected because they were essentially placed at risk given the types of jobs that they had. They were more likely to be essential workers and service workers. These were public-facing jobs. They were essentially exposed. They were also more likely to use public transportation in urban areas and more likely to live in overcrowded housing. These are all risk factors for being infected with the disease. And then to think about which communities carry the highest burden of chronic diseases, diabetes, high blood pressure, obesity, and asthma are all risk factors for doing very poorly when you are infected with coronavirus. And so those are some of the factors for why we're seeing Black, Latinx, and Indigenous communities being so disproportionately impacted by this pandemic.
Dr. Blackstock, I'd like to ask you specifically in terms of some of the figures I've seen in terms of the Latino community. For instance, here in New Jersey, 19% of the population, 30% COVID cases. In Utah, 14% of the population, 42% of the COVID cases. This whole issue, because the Latino community, generally speaking, is a much younger community than either the African American or the white community. So you would the proportion that are elderly are much smaller. Is this more a function of the underlying conditions that affect the community? For instance, diabetes and other underlying conditions in the community, or is this what other factors do you see affecting the Latino rate?
Right. And so, you know, as I mentioned, I think, you know, when we talk about who is at risk for being infected, it also depends on who is at risk for being exposed. And so, you know, I think that those numbers that you cite point to the fact that, you know, Latino community members are more likely to be working in jobs where they're at risk for being exposed. And of course, this is because of practices and policies that limit, you know, certain racial groups to certain types of jobs. And so I think that what we're seeing really are the outcomes of structural racism in this country. We have seen how, you know, life opportunities, including job opportunities, educational opportunities, have basically limited people and put people at risk to being in situations where they are more likely to be infected with coronavirus. And what I found very interesting about the New York Times piece was that we're not just seeing it in urban areas, we're seeing it in rural areas, right? So I would say that that speaks to the expansive reach of racism in this country.
You wrote a piece, Dr. Uche Blackstock, in the Washington Post, headlined, "Community health workers are essential in this crisis. We need more of them." In it, you suggest community health workers are essential to addressing this issue of systemic racism. Explain.
You know, I think that what we are seeing is that Black men, Latinx, Indigenous communities need to be really centered in this pandemic, right? They're the communities being most disproportionately impacted. And I think a key part of that is messaging and outreach. And who better to do that than people who are from those communities, trusted individuals who know the nuances of what messaging entails. And so, for example, when you are contact tracing somebody and you approach that person, you have to ask them, which people have you been in contact with? And for someone who may be undocumented, to be able to, you know, give out that information, you have to trust the person who's asking you that. So I think community health workers really have a significant role to play in this pandemic, especially in relation to mitigating the impact of this virus on racialized minority communities.
Well, I'd like to bring Dr. Sherry Fink back into the conversation and ask you a question about the numbers we're seeing in terms of the deaths from coronavirus. While the number of confirmed cases is spiraling, the defenders of President Trump say, well, the death rate has been going down. I mean, on a daily basis, it's still relatively high in the hundreds, but certainly not at the level it was earlier this year when it was in the thousands. And your sense of this shift between the confirmed cases versus deaths.
Yeah, well, that's a positive thing, certainly. We are seeing the hospitals very overstretched here in Houston. And I asked that question about the deaths. And of course, nobody knows for sure, but some of the factors that may be contributing to the deaths being lower, number one, the younger patient population with this, well, we won't say wave, it's considered the same wave, but this surge of patients is generally younger. They have better outcomes. Number two, there are things that, you know, doctors have been sharing knowledge, science has been advancing. And so there are some treatments that seem to be effective. So the physicians, the nurses, they feel that they're able to care for the patients better. That may be contributing to these better outcomes. The concern is that if the people who are younger are then going to pass the virus on to the older patient or the older population, then we may see some of this shift. And the other thing is that from infection to getting sick, to getting hospital sick, if you're going to, and then to getting critically ill, there's a lag time of weeks in between those. So even as we hopefully start to see some numbers of new infections go down or flatten, that it could be many weeks later before you know the true death toll. But the good news is it does, there are signals, it does look like it is lower.
Sherry Fink, I wanted to go to this piece that you wrote, why surviving the virus might come down to which hospital admits you. This was a piece about New York City, about public hospitals and private hospitals. The door you go through, you know, which hospital can determine whether you live or die. Explain.
So a number of doctors got a hold of some of us reporters, and they were doctors who work in multiple campuses, different hospitals. Sometimes they rotate in the private system and in the public system. And they were concerned because they felt that there were differences. And some of them got data, raw data, mortality, so the percentage of deaths, to put it simply. And there were vast differences at one campus versus another. And so they felt that there were differences in care, too. Nursing ratios were much worse at some hospitals than others. That's very, very important. So the number of patients that a nurse has, when a nurse is the one who's really monitoring that patient and able to see if they suddenly take a turn for the worst, which happens with this disease, those ratios were incredibly large, the number of patients per nurse at some hospitals. There were also modalities of treatment. So, for example, I spent a lot of time at the Brooklyn Hospital Center, this wonderful community hospital that has in Fort Greene, New York, in Brooklyn, that has no parent company, no larger system. So they're nimble, they're small, but they also don't do things that some of the bigger hospital systems do. The really ECMO, for example, this heart-lung machine, if you're really, really, really sick, they don't do continuous dialysis there, which is a form of dialysis that is sometimes used in critical care patients. So it's all to say that there are differences in the care. And as Dr. Blackstock said, these are pre-existing differences in our healthcare system, which is very unequal in New York City and likely across the country. So because people were going to their nearest hospital, that would sort of like magnify or amplify. It's sort of, there's a quote in the story that this pandemic hit on on top of an epidemic of these structural inequalities and racism. And so these are magnifying effects. I want to say an important caveat, which is that the patient populations are different that these hospitals serve. So it's this is very, very important, because if you're a hospital right near a nursing home, which some of the hospitals with the worst outcomes had, that patient population was more likely to die. They were having those underlying conditions and the higher age that does go along with death. So it's just an important signal. You know, journalism is the first draft of history. And many people who focus on health equity, like Dr. Blackstock and other researchers, are saying, we have to look more into this. We have to adjust those figures. And early signs are, even when you adjust for things like age, how ill a patient is, that in fact there are important differences between hospitals that may have to do with these differences in what they can provide.
I'd like to ask Dr. Blackstock, we have only about a minute left, but I'm wondering if your sense of this shift of the epicenter of this pandemic in the United States from the Northeast and the Midwest now to the South and the Southwest. Have you ever seen a public health crisis so politicized and so dependent on the decisions of political leaders rather than public health officials, and what the impact of that is on the Black and brown communities?
No, obviously, no, I have not. And I'm just like you, I'm alarmed and appalled. We're actually in the very early stages of this pandemic, whether we believe it or not. And, you know, there are many more deaths that could actually happen. And so I think that we have an opportunity here. We have an inflection point where we can really press on state and local officials to put interventions in place, targeted testing, contact tracing, messaging and outreach to Black and brown communities, really to prevent further devastation to the communities that have already been so hard hit.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Dr. Uche Blackstock is an emergency medicine physician and CEO of Advancing Health Equity. Dr. Sherry Fink is a New York Times correspondent, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and writer. We'll link to your pieces from Houston and New York City. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augustine Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Cami Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Adriana Contreras, Maria Tarasain, our general manager, is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, and David Prude. Stay safe by wearing a mask. You protect yourself You protect your family. You protect the community. To see all the transcripts and the video and audio podcasts of Democracy Now!, The Quarantine Report, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.